Hello, I'm John Marshall, director of the Ruesch Center for the Cure of GI Cancers at Georgetown's Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center in Washington, D.C. And I want to welcome you all to the floor, basically, of the 2014 Ruesch Center Symposium, Fighting a Smarter War Against Cancer, where we bring experts together to do just that. And this year's symposium, we are really focusing on immunotherapy, but I want to do a flashback to last year's symposium where we really targeted this concept of molecular profiling. And so as you all know, molecular profiling has sort of entered into your world, and I want to really challenge us is, are we ready for molecular profiling, and what is the impact of molecular profiling on cancer costs? Could it, in fact, lower our cancer care costs over time? So joining me, I'm really lucky to have two great colleagues across from me whose work day in and day out addresses this very issue. And I want to introduce first my good friend and partner, Dr. Mike Pishvane, who's an assistant professor here at Georgetown in the Hem-Onc Department at Lombardi's Comprehensive Cancer Center. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you very much.
And I also want to welcome Dr. Kenneth Russell, who's the Director of Clinical Affairs International for Caris Life Sciences, who flew all the way from Basel, Switzerland to join us today to have our discussion. Ken, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
We're glad you're both here. So we've got a lot of work to do in front of us, guys. So Mike, let me kind of start with you. I want to set the stage for all of our listeners who may be ordering molecular profiling tests, getting reports back, maybe not so sure what to do with those reports. Can you kind of give us a quick update? Where are we with molecular profiling? Is it genes? Is it proteins? Is it more than that? Is there one company better than the other? Is there one test better than the other? Where are we, and is it ready for prime time?
Well, a lot of questions to handle there, and I think going through things one at a time, I think we realize that we're in an era where the ability to profile not just genes, but actually the tumor cell in general, be it genomics and looking at the gene construction of the tumor cell, proteomics, looking at the enzymes that are actually acting, and even phosphoproteomics, looking at which enzymes are active and inactive, and the newer technologies as well, such as RNA sequencing, metabolomics, other ways to try and understand what's driving the cancer cell. A lot of these are ready for prime time and are even in the retail market. So our ability to order these tests has become easy. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that we should do it all the time, because part of the ability to order it also means the ability to act upon it. So getting test results that need to be actionable, that would be a benefit to our patients, is something that we need to take into consideration. And I think that's where a lot of the challenge comes from molecular profiling, because we don't necessarily know that everything that we're finding out in the tumor cells is actually actionable, meaning that it will make a difference in the patient's disease process. And we don't necessarily know how things mingle together. How do chemotherapy predictive markers mingle with genetic predictive markers and mingle with phosphoproteomic predictive markers? So I think there's a tremendous amount of research that we need to do. But at the same time, these things are available for patients who are suffering from advanced disease today.
Let me ask you a quick basic question. So do I need new tumor, and how much do I need?
So I'm definitely of the camp philosophically that believes that the newest tumor that you can get access to is the most representative of that patient's cancer today. So a patient who had a colon cancer removed 5 years ago, and then they had their tumor come back 2 years ago, and they've been on 2 years of chemotherapy, it's really probably not very reflective of their disease overall to look back at that tumor from 5 years ago. So you really want to look at what's going on in the tumor today. How much do you need depends upon the company or the internal process that's testing. Some companies do better with using very little tissue, and some companies need a lot of tissue. Obviously, I think the philosophy would be that if we can use as little tissue as possible to get as much information, as broad information as possible about that patient's tumor that we could act upon, that's ideal.
And this tumor heterogeneity thing, I mean, we've seen evidence where you biopsy one side, you get a different result on the other. Any dealing with that so far? We still just got to face the music on that.
I think that that's the 800-pound girl in the room that I think a lot of us don't even know necessarily what to deal with. Now, keeping in mind that the tumor heterogeneity is much more at the genetic level, so there are a lot of genes that differ from one core to another within the same tumor, but we don't necessarily know that that changes the phenotype, how the actual cancer behaves, and we certainly see patients who have a certain kind of mutation, an EGFR mutation in a non-small cell lung cancer. Usually, most of the tumor shrink down in concert. So while there is a tremendous amount of heterogeneity, how that actually influences patient outcome in response to a specific targeted therapy, we still don't really know.
Yeah, no. So part of our drill down today is about cost, but you just suggested that we need a new biopsy, and usually CT-guided or something like that. So there's both risk to the patient, but also cost. We're doing this, I know. We're in the trenches doing this. Give me a little feeling on how that's getting paid for. Has that been a real trouble for you and for us as a team?
Well, so far I don't think we've had much trouble getting it paid for, whether that's right or wrong. I obviously am biased and think it's right. I think an insurance company should be willing to pay for something that's going to change the patient's management. And that's really why we're doing these biopsies, to see what we need to do to change that patient's therapy to maximize their options. So far it has not been a tremendous problem. There is a problem, or at least an education that has to occur on the people who are doing the procedures. I had a good friend of mine who's an interventional radiologist tell me that for his entire training, he was trained to use as little tissue as possible to make the diagnosis. And now we're going back to him and saying, we need as much tissue as you can safely get from that patient without harming them. So it is a different mindset.
Now, these assays that are being done, they're kind of evolving too, right? So what's normal, what's not normal, what's positive, what's negative? Tell me a little bit about what we know there.
Most of the people who are doing the assays, whether it's at the academic center, or it usually starts at the academic center, but even as it's going into retail companies, most of it compares to some broad population norm, whether that's a protein like thymidylate synthase, whether it's a gene like KRAS. They have a sense of what the normal gene should look like across the population, and they're looking for abnormalities. And I think a lot of the responsibility of the physician, the companies, the academic institutions across the world, we need to try and keep looking at the evidence behind that and seeing if we need to shift the bar on what we call a positive versus a negative. I had an experience recently where one of the companies said they've looked at a lot of their internal data, and they realize they need to shift the bar way down on what they're calling a negative to really translate that into something that's useful for patients.
And on the gene mutation side of things, I mean, is it one copy? Is that enough where you have a mutation and that represents the entire tumor? Mm-hmm. Or do we need higher copies? Right now we seem to be on the low end of that, right?
Yeah. You know, one of the blessings of next-gen sequencing is the ability to pick up small amounts of tissue to pick up DNA mutations, but the downside to that is that we can be too sensitive. So a lot of these blood-based tests that are picking up mutations with just a blood sample of circulating DNA, they're super sensitive, and that's great because you actually don't have to bother biopsying the patient's tumor, but it could also be overly sensitive and not representative, and I think we just still don't know yet.
And one last sort of thing, where as clinicians, so you get this report back, what's your level of certainty of using this evidence to pick either picking a medicine or saying, no, we're not going to use that medicine? Where are we there?
So a lot of the data that we have comes from large trials, usually retrospective, the KRAS story and colorectal cancer being one of the best examples, where we had a large data set and they went back and looked. And that was a great story because you had a very stark difference in response to EGFR therapy in KRAS wild type versus KRAS mutant. But unfortunately, a lot of our ability to scan a much broader gene profile or molecular profile also means we're really picking out needles in the haystack and a lot of anecdotal examples. And I think we just need to keep building those anecdotal examples until they become larger subgroups. Now, the best application of this will be things like the NCI Match study, where they're going to actually look at a group, not a tremendously large group, but they're going to look at 20 to 40 patients with a certain kind of mutation and treat them with what we think the right drug is and look for at least an initial signal, kind of the I-SPY2 model things, and Dr. Barry is involved in the statistics of that study as well. That'll be very, very informative, and from everything I hear, is going to happen very quickly.
Ken, now for the hard part. We're excited about this. This is cool technology. It's starting to make its way into the mainstream. We even see ASCO officially saying we need to be doing this and figuring out how to get access to the medicine. So we like this scientifically. We like it medically. How do we justify this added cost of the test, if we think of it as that way? How are we looking at this as a population process? How do we convince our payers and our supporters to say, you know what, this is not going to cost us more. This will, in fact, save us money in the end. And I know you've been doing lots of work around the world, sort of ex-US, on this. Share with us where we are on this, because I think you may represent one of the leading forces in this discussion. Take it away.
Well, I think the question of whether it will save money or cost money is the million-dollar question. It's not even the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And what we have to think about is not money wasted when we do this, because it's providing information and valuable information. And we need to think of the value of that information and look at it as money invested. And I think what we have is we've looked at a number of physician-led studies now where we're generating information on how broad molecular profiling is used. And these are done in patients who are past standard of care. So they're either refractory to the standard of care treatment options, or they have a rare cancer where there's limited treatment options. And what we know is that this is a difficult patient to treat, because you're basing the treatment decision on just your empiric choice. And that means that you'll pick a therapy from what's available or from another tumor type based on the physician's experience, the individual patient's performance status, how they've responded to treatment in the past and what they've been treated with. All of these factors go into a physician's decision in this case. And what we're saying is that using tumor profiling, we can make this educated guess more educated, and we can use extra information to help in the treatment decision. And what we've seen is that in taking a broad approach to this, where we look at protein changes using immunohistochemistry, looking at gene expression using in situ hybridization, the position of mutations with next-gen sequencing and other sort of tumor profiling tests, we can build a comprehensive picture. And by doing this, you can get the widest view, which will allow you to take information from other tumor types, to learn from your successes in other tumor types. And the sort of anecdotes that are building up and showing that there's utility for this kind of thing in treating based on tumor process rather than the tumor type. And what we see is that when all of this is taken into account, the report that we generate is actionable in about 95% of cases, and that it's actually impacting the physician's decision in about 85% of cases. So they're using that information to change what they would have given without molecular profiling, to change it to what they actually administered to the patient. And obviously that's important information. Mm. And the other thing that we see is that basically physicians would treat with chemotherapy. It's what they're, if they want to continue treatment, most of them will use a chemotherapy rather than an expensive targeted therapy. It's where the patients are at in their sort of their treatment plan is to come to that phase. And what we see is that the most popular treatments that would have been given are sort of cytotoxics like 5-FU and irinotecan. And what was actually given after the tumor profiling was predominantly cytotoxics, 5-FU and irinotecan. And what you see is that across a population, you see similar usage, but what you're seeing is a reallocation of the available chemotherapy resources to patients who are more likely to benefit. So you're seeing some patients where it's confirmed, some patients where it's given and wouldn't previously have been considered, and some patients where it's avoided. So I think the idea of avoiding chemotherapies that are less likely to work in patients who don't show that they have a benefit is where you'll see some cost savings as well. Obviously, you're treating another patient in the population, but I think what the important thing is the reallocation. Yeah. And I think even if it's sort of cost neutral or slightly adds on, I think what we need to look for is this being offset by improved treatment outcomes, where the patients who we're using the resources that we have to treat patients who are more likely to benefit, and we're avoiding it in patients who won't.
That's exactly what I was thinking. So in some places around the world, this would be a patient who would not necessarily get further therapy or might just get doctor's best guess therapy, right? Yeah. And so in a way, we are adding costs because we're seeking new options for a patient that had run out of options. So, and if we find them, so the biopsy, the molecular profile, the treatment adds cost. Are we under sort of a more pressure to define the value of the impact of that treatment in that setting, to really show that that treatment is actually having a positive impact? And what are sort of governments and payers expecting of us on that level?
Well, I think what we need to do is we need to test this, and we need to look at it prospectively and to measure it, because, you know, it's really difficult to create a model around tumor profiling and say that we can go and draw on a a whiteboard or a blackboard and work out what the treatment algorithm should look like based on the outcomes, and you need to actually use it. And what the payers want to see is, first of all, decision impact, because if you're changing what the physician would have done, then there's value in that. And if you have a system or an approach where you're impacting that, you're helping, because you're taking away the burden of uncertainty. And uncertainty is looked on as being costly by payers. So if they say that this treatment decision is being supported by evidence from even another tumor type where there's not been an approval, especially in rare tumor types where it's going to be impossible for a pharma company to look at building a study in this sort of patient cohort. But if we can show, using the best profiling that we have, that there's a potential susceptibility of the tumor to a particular treatment, and we can show maybe one or two case reports of that, and we can put all this together, then that's supporting the decision. And I think that's what the payers are looking for. Mm-hmm. They're looking for a degree of certainty being added to this.
Yeah. So I think a very exciting recent sort of position paper by Rich Schilsky out of ASCO was, yes, we need to do this, and yes, we want the pharmaceutical companies to provide us with the medicines, if you will, free of charge, but in exchange for the information to the payers, to the profilers, to the physician, of did it improve outcome for that, in a way of sort of innovating new indications, as you define. Is this where you see us going as a way to justify the added cost, is to prove that added benefit? You like that position paper from Rich?
Yeah, I mean, showing the added benefit is the key. And I think we can only do it by working together, research and the tumor profiling companies and the pharma companies can work together to bring this forward. I think what we need to also engage with is the payers and look for what information they're looking for. So it's only really with a multidisciplinary and a broad approach we're going to actually prove this, because, you know, we could be here for the next 20 years doing something that's helping patients today and trying to prove a question, when, you know, we can invest in a 3-year study, and then in 3 years we're looking at completely different technologies, completely different sort of battery of tests that we have available, companion diagnostics, and actual drugs as well. You know, what we have at the moment is that we find with NGS in particular, you can find a lot of actionable changes that, and alterations in the gene makeup that aren't druggable. And that's something that, you know, we might look back in 5 years and say, look, we were able to find that mutation, but we never had a drug for it. And, you know, then does the question come about, do we need to prove the health economics of this? Is it something that we can just work on today and prove forever, or is it something we need to continually look at? And I think these are all questions that we need to sort of work out. And
I need you to share with our audience your experience with the National Health Service. We think of this, and the NICE committee and all of that, is really being one of the most discerning and strict groups for, you know, accepting what are expensive but new therapies. Yeah. And you were sharing with me that you've been working with the NHS to try and understand how they would incorporate molecular profiling. Share with that.
Yeah, so we've worked with the NHS, and we've applied for a regional innovation fund in the UK to look at a group of patients with rare or gynecological cancers, and to see how tumor profiling can help these patients with their treatments. And obviously one of the things they're interested in is how this impacts on the costs associated. So we will look to work with them on showing the value of the information and show how it's improving outcomes, but also really have some concrete, you know, evidence of what the costs added are. Because, you know, if you find a mutation that you weren't expecting and there's a valuable drug against it, say a BRAF mutation where you're not expecting to look for it, then that's going to add to your cost for that patient. But across the whole population, is it really having an impact on the resources? And then is it something that can fit into practice?
Yeah, so one last thing, and I'm going to ask you both. I'll start with you, Ken. So we're used to now sort of a la carte molecular testing. KRAS, a year ago, now it's extended RAS, you know, microsatellite, and this is just colorectal cancer. But we're ticking off a la carte. And each one of those events is a slide needs to be cut, a tumor, you know, it has to be tested. Are there cost savings in the sort of pan profiles that are out there? As you say, we're learning about targets as we go. If I've already got it in the bank and I found out 2 years from now it's a good target, are there cost savings that we factor into our analysis?
Yeah. I think the illustration you gave of the pan-RAS testing is very good, because this is something where KRAS has traditionally been looked at for cetuximab, but you can also find NRAS or HRAS mutations, which could be an escape mechanism from blockade of the, you're not just looking at the KRAS mutation. It could also be that an NRAS mutation is driving the disease through that, and that you won't see effectiveness of an EGFR inhibitor. I think what we also know is that if we're looking at just one mutation, say we go and try to find BRAF mutations in a population where there's a 3% mutation prevalence, it's not sustainable to just look at that one test and to have 97% of your results non-informative for the patients. You need to take a broad view, because you need to catch that 3%, but you also need to have something that will help the other 97% of patients. By taking as broad a view as possible, we can do that today. And like you say, we might look back in 2 years and have that information in the bank, and we can go back and say, you know what, this new drug's there, why don't we put the patient to this clinical trial, or why don't we use that information? So as I started with, it's an investment in what we can have for the patients. It's always going to be changing, it's always going to be broadening probably, but by doing the best that we can today, we're sort of securing that.
And Mike, related question, even though we're doing 600 genes in next-gen sequencing and lots of proteins and now phosphoproteins and the like, are we still looking under the streetlight? I mean, are there other genes out there that we're not testing, that we're not measuring? Or do you think we've got most of the cancer-relevant genes under our umbrella now?
I think that there's a lot that we don't know. I think that the 400 or 600 genes are those that have been deemed cancer-related. Mm-hmm. But, there's 30,000 genes out there. And certainly when whole genome sequencing anecdotal presentations have been done, they do find more to act upon that wouldn't necessarily have been captured in just just cancer-related exome sequencing or even whole exome sequencing. So I think that someday we may get to a point where we're actually trying to capture all of the genes as well as all the intronic sequences that may actually affect the ability of the genes to be transcribed appropriately. And then getting into phosphoproteomics, there's a handful. We don't really necessarily look at phosphoproteomics right now. We look at the expression levels of certain key enzymes. But to actually be looking at what's actionable or activated in that phosphoproteome signaling pathway may also be relevant. And there's also thousands of those in kind of the kinome.
Okay, I want to wrap this up a little bit, and I want to give you each a shot at this. And Ken, I'll start with you. But we're excited about this, but I can't help but feel that there's a risk that we might be going down the wrong path. And I just give me in a sense of your assessment of that risk. I mean, if we keep doing this over the next 5-10 years, we can see how it might help. What are the risks that that we're not going down the right path?
Well, I think what we have to remember is what else can we do for these patients? There's a lot of patients where we won't have any other information that we can use. So we can keep doing what we're doing, like the polar bear in the zoo that demonstrates insanity and keeps doing it over and over again. Mm-hmm. Or we can try to use the best information that we have. Mm-hmm. Now, the information is always changing, and the information that we're generating about the approach is always changing. The initial senses that we have are that it's helping patients. We've seen in evaluations by physicians that they've looked and they've shown better outcomes. Now we need to start looking at that in more detail, become more confident with it. And I think the thing that it can offer a physician today is confidence in how they're treating their patients. You might look back in 5 years and say, what was I doing? But at the time, you're using the best information.
Okay, Mike?
I think that the biggest obstacle that we might have is if we don't study this properly, and I don't necessarily mean it in a detailed prospective clinical trial, although that would certainly be the gold standard, but we're going to be profiling lots and lots of patients, and we really want to capture all of that data. So the burden is on every one of the physician oncologists in the country and really worldwide to be collecting that data, because a lot of us are using these reports to use off-label therapy, and if we're not telling anybody how those patients did, if we're not formally putting it into a database somewhere that somebody initiates, then we're losing a valuable piece of information.
Yeah. So and all then, that work we do all weekend entering into our electronic medical record, we're building the haystack?
Yes, we need to build that haystack big so that we understand where the needles are. And sometimes it's really important because there certainly are some key actionable mutations that don't mean anything in certain disease types. There are anecdotes that abound that we really think we have the actionable gene mutation, but for some reason in this disease it doesn't work where it worked really well in this disease.
Yeah, this has been terrific. I really thank you very much. I hope our audience has gotten something out of this, both thought-provoking, but also sort of inspiring them to begin incorporating this kind of process, to do that data entry that's so important for us to understand the outcome. So Ken and Mike, thank you so much for taking the time out from our symposium and the like to join us. So really, thank you for joining us, our audience out there, for joining the Roush Center, and particularly Medscape, who's helping to support this and tell the story of what's going on out there in cancer care today. So this is John Marshall reporting from the 2014 Roush Center Symposium in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much.